You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. We keep moving. In a Vanity Fair exclusive, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter reflects on Trump's decision to declassify the civil rights leader's assassination files, her father's legacy, and the future of the movement, by Bernice A. King. In the photos, under watch, Martin Luther King Jr. is arrested outside a Montgomery, Alabama courthouse, September 1958. FBI file, March 1968. FBI chronology following MLK's assassination. Funeral for the civil rights leader in Atlanta, April 1968. And Bernice A. King. On March 28, 1968, I celebrated my fifth birthday. Unbeknownst to me, it would be the last time I would celebrate my birthday with my father. 7 days later, on April 4th, Daddy was assassinated. For years, I tried to figure out, what did my father do? Why did they assassinate him? As a five-year-old, I reasoned that Daddy was a good person who loved everybody and whom everybody loved. Why would anybody want to kill him? People who stood up for the least of these, I reasoned, were not supposed to be killed. I know now that waging a nonviolent fight for justice is dangerous work. As my siblings and I grew up without a father, we were often reminded that he was assassinated while seeking to make the world a better place. And there were more assassination attempts to come. These were assassination attempts on his reputational character. Our mother, Coretta Scott King, prepared us for these repeated attempts, saying, "They keep trying to assassinate your father over and over again." At times, public discourse about my father slithered into slander to undermine the importance and impact of his legacy, and I learned to brace myself for the attempted assassinations by keeping my mother's words close to my heart. By the time we matured into adulthood, we had developed the composure necessary to stand before the nation and the world each April 4th. Laying a wreath on Daddy's crypt reminded us of what can happen when the forces of hate and injustice have no bounds. We watched my mother's example as she continued his work. My siblings and I accepted our roles to advance our dad's work in our own ways. Today, I am not writing in my role as CEO of the King Center to address the government's recent release of assassination records. Today, instead, I wonder why I have to be confronted once again with something that was very confusing and distressing for me as a five-year-old. I am honestly not prepared to revisit the gruesome details of this painful history. For me, there is no real value in it. There is only reliving the trauma. This past January, 3 days after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, which coincided with the inauguration, President Trump signed an executive order to declassify records associated with my father's assassination. Along with those corresponding to the killings of President John F. Kennedy and his brother, Senator Robert F. Kennedy. "That's a big one," the president said of the directive. "Everything will be revealed." The assassination of my father was investigated by the FBI in 1968, by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s, and then once again by the Department of Justice in the 1990s. The final investigation occurred during a wrongful death lawsuit brought by my family in civil court in 1999. 2 years earlier, my late brother, Dexter, had visited James Earl Ray in prison and looked into his eyes to ask him if he had killed our father. Ray responded, no. Despite the official narrative that the FBI and its then-director, J. Edgar Hoover, crafted about Ray's role as the sole assassin, our family believes that Ray was not the assassin, but a scapegoat used by a large and powerful network, one that included informants whom the FBI recruited from within my father's camp. Much of this was corroborated in the courtroom in 1999 after hearing from some 70 witnesses over the course of 4 weeks during the wrongful death trial. A Memphis jury concluded that government entities conspired in the assassination. Our family views that verdict as an affirmation of our long-held beliefs. My family needed to know the truth about who assassinated Daddy. The civil trial provided answers and began to help me answer my childhood question, why? According to then FBI Assistant Director William Sullivan, my father was the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. I believe the 1962 launch of Operation Breadbasket, a strategic, multifaceted effort to end economic discrimination, along with my father's ability to captivate the imaginations of more than 250,000 Americans at the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August 28, 1963, heightened the government's determination to assassinate his character through the covert and now infamous FBI counterintelligence program COINTELPRO. This determination was further intensified by his public opposition to the Vietnam War, which he resoundingly conveyed in his speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. Delivered on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year before he was assassinated, the speech included Daddy's admonishment that the United States government was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. When the government's attempt at character assassination failed, another option prevailed. He was ultimately assassinated. "We've got some difficult days ahead," Daddy said on the eve of his murder, a cruel act of state-sanctioned violence. His words were prescient. "There are grave risks now, as there were then, in fighting for justice through nonviolence, advocating for the poor, and opposing war." Next photo, looking to the future, King feeding young Bernice during a Sunday dinner. 57 years after he was assassinated, the man who was the target of an overreaching government in search of communism is now honored with a federal holiday and a national memorial on the Mall in our nation's capital. While the country and world commemorate his birthday and multitudes invoke his words, we have not yet, collectively and with earnest intent, embraced and applied his nonviolent mindset and methods. Still, his legacy and influence on policies, practices, and people across the globe are powerful and tangible evidence of the power of nonviolence. We are in touch with his wisdom and must apply it as humanity faces this critical juncture. Kingian nonviolence both galvanizes a movement and exposes injustice. It is needed now more than ever. For these are indeed difficult days, days when my father's very work to create a more inclusive society and economy is threatened with closures and removals of important history, programs, initiatives, information, and services designed to advance genuine equality, days when aid is cut off from nations grappling with dire poverty, days when militarism persists and entire families perish, days when voter suppression goes unchecked by the highest court in the land, days when thousands of hardworking Americans are laid off in the name of government efficiency, and days when hope lies prostrate and must be lifted and levied by people jointly determined to keep moving. So we keep moving. As a king and the daughter of two global leaders who showed me what's possible when consciousness, compassion, and consistency meet, I keep moving. There may continue to be commentary, cruelty, and controversy for me to navigate. I encourage a collective focus on reviving the revolutionary, love-centered movement that my parents and other courageous, hopeful people cultivated. I implore the global community, which my father called the World House, to think higher, love deeper, and broaden our coalitions for the common good. Most of all, I encourage compassionate action and strategic use of Kingian nonviolence in working to defeat what Daddy called the triple evils of racism, militarism, and poverty. As he said in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community. Let us choose community, and in Daddy's words, make of this world, this old world, a new world. A Chan of Heart by Evgenia Peretz, with opening illustration of Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg by Diego Malo. In 2015, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan built a philanthropic behemoth in their image, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Science forward, research backed, driven by empathy. But as Zuckerberg and Meta have tacked right, ditching DEI, insiders say Chan has become a proxy figure in the battle between her husband's company and their progressive CZI staff. In photos, April 2011, President Barack Obama with Mark Zuckerberg during a town hall event at Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto, California. July 2011, Priscilla Chan and Zuckerberg at the Allen & Company Sun Valley Conference in Sun Valley, Idaho. Priscilla Chan met the moment with the kind of grace and sensitivity she'd become known for. It was July 2020. George Floyd had recently been murdered, and staffers at the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the foundation she started with her husband Mark Zuckerberg in 2015, were hurting. Tissues on hand, eyes welling up, she hosted an all-hands Zoom to address them. It didn't feel right to not actually just spend the time as an organization acknowledging the, in medicine we call it, acute on chronic, racial disaster that is our country, she said, hands clasped in front of her in a video obtained by Vanity Fair. If there was a silver lining, it was that the moment was so bad, change was imperative, both in the country at large and at CZI, whatever that would entail. That's my little hopeful pearl that I want to try to add. We stand with the Black community. We stand with our Black employees. It's felt harder and more important than ever to get a lot of our work right. The work would take time, she acknowledged, but she implored her employees to take care of yourself, make sure you're giving yourself the space, the grace. 4.5 years later, Chan appeared at President Donald Trump's second inauguration alongside her husband on the dais, a spot usually reserved for the president's nearest and dearest. Zuckerberg had been cozying up to MAGA world for some time and had just come off an appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast, where he, buff and in a new gold chain, ragged on the Biden administration and lamented a lack of masculine energy in the workplace. But to some, Chan looked uncomfortable at the inauguration, and the optics weren't computing. Through CZI, she'd spent hundreds of millions on biomedical research. Yet here she was, standing a few feet from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, a science skeptic. She appeared to make small talk with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who was soon to cut billions in foreign aid, including for life-saving HIV treatment in Africa. To many of Chan's colleagues and admirers from the philanthropy world, the image was distressing. To them, Chan represented, perhaps still does, they hope, everything antithetical to the president she was honoring. If Trump was their idea of a nightmare billionaire, Chan was their dream. They knew her to be unflashy and disciplined, driven by the conviction that everyone deserves a chance to overcome the circumstance of their birth. She was profoundly empathetic, easily moved to tears at the suffering of others. What could she have been feeling, some of those contacts wondered, celebrating such a gleefully callous man? Later, Zuckerberg posted a photo of the two of them in black tie on their way to an inauguration party he was co-hosting with the caption, "Feeling optimistic." 7 months into the administration, that appears to be gutting everything she has held dear, scientific research, higher education, public health, caring for those in need. It's hard to imagine that Chan, at least, is feeling optimistic, but she has remained largely silent. Chan declined to be interviewed for this story. Many former colleagues and admirers from nonprofit circles are searching for signs of the woman they knew and floating the questions. I know they are separate people. And frankly, Priscilla comes off as a lot more human than Mark, says Lucia Reynoso, a former CZI engineer, but they are married and gave the impression of a united front. So is she aligned with her husband? Has she been ideologically moved by the right-wing plutocracy? Or is she still working toward the greater good, maintaining her silence out of a sense of pragmatism? Next photos, September 2015. Chan and Zuckerberg arrive for the state dinner for Chinese President Xi Jinping and his wife Peng Yuan at the White House. August 2016, Pope Francis with Zuckerberg and Chan at the Vatican. If Trump had been president 50 years ago, Chan's parents might never have found their way to this country. They were ethnic Chinese immigrants from Vietnam who had each fled the war-torn country by boat. They met upon arrival in the U.S., married, and settled in the working-class neighborhood of Quincy, Massachusetts. They worked in a Chinese restaurant and raised three daughters. Priscilla was the eldest. At the local public high school, Chan excelled in science and on the tennis court, became valedictorian, and got into Harvard on a full scholarship, the first person in her family to go to college. It was there that she met Zuckerberg in October 2003, standing in line for the bathroom at a frat party. It was not his finest hour. He had just built FaceMash, his Who's Hotter website, featuring images of Harvard girls side by side. The site had spread like wildfire on campus, and now he was set to go before Harvard's administrative board. But one can imagine he fulfilled a need in Chan. She'd felt a sense of awe and alienation upon getting to Harvard, what with all the privileged, hyper-educated kids in private school cliques. But here was one such boy who'd gone to Phillips Exeter Academy, and he was interested. He was a brilliant nerd who, she found, speaks in a whole new language and lives in a framework that I've never seen before, as she told The New Yorker in 2018. He spent the months after they met building Facebook from his dorm room, then dropped out to go to Silicon Valley. Meanwhile, her life path presented itself to her when she met a girl from the Dorchester Housing Project, where Chan was mentoring. The girl's front teeth had been knocked out. It was heartbreaking to Chan, a biology major, and it confirmed to her a calling to serve children in need. After she graduated in 2007, she joined Zuckerberg in San Francisco, where she taught science at an elementary school and then began medical school at UCSF. As a condition to her move, she made him commit to one date night a week and 100 uninterrupted minutes away from Facebook. He was then growing Facebook at warp speed. He turned down an offer from Yahoo to purchase it for $1 billion, and now, after an investment from Microsoft of $240 million, the company was valued at $15 billion. Chan told The New Yorker, "I had to realize early on that I was not going to change who Mark was, but she could try to guide him in a world of real-life humans." They spent weekends together, doing earnest activities like watching their favorite show, The West Wing, created by Aaron Sorkin, who would go on to write the screenplay for The Social Network, and playing Settlers of Catan, and in 2010, she moved in. By that point, roughly one out of every 12 people across the globe had a Facebook account. Its promise was epic, to do nothing short of connect the entire world and to help people maintain empathy for each other, as he told Time magazine, where he was named Person of the Year at age 26. In line with his status, Zuckerberg began honing his legacy. His hero had been fellow tech billionaire Bill Gates, who in 2010 launched the Giving Pledge, challenging other billionaires to promise to give away at least half of their fortunes before death. I encouraged them to start early, Gates says, of early conversations with both Zuckerberg and Chan about philanthropy, noting that Priscilla is leading one of the most ambitious scientific and philanthropic organizations in a generation. Taking his cue, Zuckerberg announced with fanfare on the Oprah Winfrey Show that he would be donating $100 million to Newark Public Schools. The results of that effort were mixed, which educators have attributed to the project's insufficient collaboration with the community. A CZI spokesperson disputes the criticism, pointing to independent research that found improvement in graduation rates and gains in student achievement. Chan later told him that if he was going to be serious about education, he should probably have some real-life experience teaching. At her urging, he gave it a whirl by teaching a class on entrepreneurship at a boys and girls club. Meanwhile, Chan was all in, doing high-stakes trauma work at San Francisco General Hospital. It was gunshot wound after gunshot wound, recalls a close friend. She was the friend who's always exhausted after doing a double shift. She also took part in a special UCSF program designed to improve the health of underserved children. Facebook went public on May 18, 2012. Chan and Zuckerberg, now worth an estimated $19 billion, married the next day. Next photos, May 2019. Zuckerberg meets with French President Emmanuel Macron at the Élysée Palace in Paris. July 2020, Zuckerberg surfing in Hawaii. In 2015, the couple began two major projects, which they made a point of connecting, CZI and their family. After multiple miscarriages, Chan was pregnant with their first child. According to the recent memoir, Careless People, by former Facebook employee Sarah Wynne Williams, whom Meta has legally blocked from personally promoting the book on the basis that she has potentially violated her contract, while Zuckerberg and his team were in Indonesia, he floated the idea to his co-workers that he might not be present for the birth. Not that there was any particular conflict, just that something more important might come up at work. He relayed that he'd spoken with Chan about the possibility. As Wynne Williams claimed, Chan told Mark that she would be totally fine with him skipping the delivery, but that he might come to regret missing the birth of his first child. Mark was, of course, present from the beginning to the end of all three hospitalizations and deliveries for all three of their children, says a source close to the couple. This was not something they discussed. A few months before the birth, in September 2015, Zuckerberg attended a White House dinner and spoke with President Xi Jinping of China, where he was desperate to launch Facebook. Wynne Williams claimed that he asked if Xi would do him the honor of naming his unborn child. Xi declined. They ended up naming the baby Maxima. Max. Zuckerberg had long been fixated by the Roman emperors and would go on to name their other two daughters, Auguste and Aurelia. Careless People is a mix of out-of-date and previously reported claims about the company and false accusations about our executives, a Meta spokesperson said upon the book's publication. Next photos. January 2024. Zuckerberg speaks during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing titled Big Tech and the Online Child Sexual Exploitation Crisis on Capitol Hill. February 2024, Chan and Zuckerberg look on as Amanda Lemos of Brazil grapples with Mackenzie Dern in their women's strawweight fight during UFC 298 at the Honda Center in Anaheim, California. Max's birth coincided with the unveiling of CZI, which shook the philanthropy world, At its founding, the couple wrote a public letter to their new baby that both spoke of the promise of science and was suffused with Obama-era feel-good progressivism. Our hopes for your generation focus on two ideas, advancing human potential and promoting equality, they wrote. Promoting equality is about making sure everyone has access to these opportunities, regardless of nation, families, or circumstances they are born into. They announced they would be giving away 99% of their shares in Facebook in their lifetime, then valued at $45 billion, to the organization. The mission was to fix almost everything. On the science front, CZI would help cure, prevent, and manage all disease over the next century. To Corey Bargman, the first CZI head of science, that audacious goal was a meeting of the couple's essences. Zuckerberg, the big-thinking engineer, and Chan, the pediatrician, driven to find the often elusive answers to ailments afflicting young patients. She was really motivated by this idea to help children, says Bargman. And there were just children you could not help, because there was no help. And for her, science is hope. CZI zeroed in on the goal of creating a human cell atlas, a reference for understanding every single cell in the human body, of which there are 37 trillion. CZI wouldn't just make grants. It would also create tech tools and form its own biohubs, research centers, bringing together scientists at the top universities. According to Sam Hawgood, chancellor of UCSF and a CZI Biohub Network board member, CZI's big picture goal set it apart from other biomedical philanthropies that might focus on a single disease. The great thing is their recognition that big breakthroughs in health come from long-term investments in fundamental, curiosity-driven science, Hawgood says. Next photos, April 2024. Chan and Zuckerberg attend the UFC 300 event at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. January 2025. Chan, Zuckerberg, Lauren Sanchez, Jeff Bezos, Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, and Elon Musk, among other dignitaries, at the second inauguration of President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. On the promoting equality front, they would remake public education and take on immigration and criminal justice reform, housing, and community. They laid out their ethos to Baby Max. If you fear you'll go to prison rather than college because of the color of your skin, or that your family will be deported because of your legal status, or that you may be a victim of violence because of your religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity, then it's difficult to reach your full potential. It was personal to Chan, who would run the day-to-day operations, while Zuckerberg would advise. She had been lucky, she often said, to have had teachers who believed in her and nurtured her, but it was fundamentally unjust that people needed luck to have access to opportunities. T-shirts were made, a future for everyone. Scientists, nonprofit types, and left-leaning politicos flocked to work for them, like Obama advisor David Plouffe, who would run the Justice and Opportunity Initiative, and Jim Shelton, who worked in the Obama Education Department and came on to lead CZI's education initiative. It was like their beloved West Wing, but set at a charitable endeavor with limitless funds. The office, a single open space in downtown Menlo Park, was casual and non-hierarchical, a tone set by Chan, early employees recall. Even though she had some security measures in place for herself, she was approachable. Her desk was out in the open, and she chatted like any regular employee, about kids, the martial arts class she was taking, pop culture. The couple made concerted efforts to bring staff into the fold to ask whatever they wanted in a weekly all-hands meeting. Chan, in particular, was an active listener. Maurice Wilkins, who was head of DEI until he left in 2019, recalls, it's not like she was a critical race theory expert, any of that stuff, but she always took the posture of, all right, I'm willing to learn, and I want to do the right thing. She seemed very genuine about wanting to get it right. And she pushed herself further, opening her own CZI-funded school with the late educator Meredith Liu for the most underserved children of East Palo Alto, near Facebook's first offices. It was called the Primary School, and it would focus on the whole child, integrating health, social-emotional learning, SEL, and family support. Akemi Gibson, at the time a VP at Sesame Street Workshop, which consulted with the school on SEL, recalls, she spoke emphatically and passionately about the relationship between health, education, and poverty. The tech boom in Palo Alto had driven real estate prices up, forcing an exodus of poor and working-class people. According to Gibson, it was clear she was aware of our concern about the reputation of Facebook displacing families, as many families were vulnerable, living in cars or their vans, and with little resources. Still, CZI insisted to people inside and outside the organization that it ran independently of Facebook. Staffers understood that they shouldn't get too bent out of shape by, say, learning that Zuckerberg had met with Trump. Next photo, March 2025. Chan on stage at a featured session, A Future Without Disease, a conversation on shaping the next era of science with AI at South by Southwest in Austin. There was a lot of grace for Priscilla, says Ray Meadows, formerly Holgado, a former grants manager at CZI's Justice and Opportunity Manager in CZI's Justice and Opportunity Division. I think folks gave her the benefit of the doubt for a long time, but with a shared CEO and Zuckerberg, it was increasingly hard for many to escape the sense that Facebook loomed over everything, especially when things started going sideways. In 2018, CZI had to contend with the fallout from the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the revelation that a Trump-aligned political consulting firm had gathered data from 87 million Facebook users without their consent and targeted them with personalized ads prior to the 2016 election. Zuckerberg was dragged before Congress for the first time, where he was grilled not just about the company's privacy practices, but about the platform's addictive nature and how it was coarsening the public discourse and contributing to ethnic violence, particularly in Myanmar, where a genocide was taking place. Senator Lindsey Graham took him to task for the company's 2016 internal memo, written by then-Vice President of Facebook Andrew Bosworth, subject line The Ugly, that read in part, "We connect people, period. That can be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs someone a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. And still we connect people. The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good." Zuckerberg came through with what was widely regarded as a slap on the wrist fine for Facebook. A few days later, he was even some $1 billion richer. But his reputation was bruised, and some at CZI worried that its image would be bruised by association and that CZI needed to work harder to distinguish itself from Facebook. That work appeared to fall to Chan, who shied away from the spotlight, but now seemed to take on a more robust role as the friendly public face of the organization. She went on CNN, for example, where she emphasized that the company was majority women, as B-roll showed women in a conference room laughing. On the Today Show in 2020, she took the opportunity to come to her husband's defense, seeing him at home and in his work grappling with these massive questions that sometimes don't have clear answers, she said. I am proud of how he's been handling all of this, and I know he's doing his hardest, and I wish others could see it. A CZI spokesperson says that Cambridge Analytica had no impact on Priscilla's role at CZI, which has always been to serve as the day-to-day leader of the organization, including speaking publicly about CZI's work. But more controversy was brewing. Behind the scenes at Facebook that cut ever closer to the bone of part of Chan's life's work, children's health. In 2019 and 2020, Facebook's internal research demonstrated that its app Instagram was harming teenagers, with conclusions such as, we make body images worse for 1 in 3 teen girls, and teens blame Instagram for increases in the rate of anxiety and depression. Another finding stated that among teenagers with suicidal thoughts, 13% of British teens and 6% of American teens traced those feelings to Instagram. Until Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen leaked to the Wall Street Journal in 2021 in what became part of the paper's series, The Facebook Files, the news had not made its way to the public. Zuckerberg, Haugen later testified, had been reluctant to take the steps necessary to address the problem. More safety meant less time on the platform, and thus fewer ad dollars. The Facebook Files will be the basis for Aaron Sorkin's upcoming follow-up to The Social Network, which he will also direct. A representative for Sorkin did not respond to Vanity Fair as to whether Chan will be depicted. Prior to the scandal breaking, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt was studying social media and its adverse effect on kids for his future book, 2024's groundbreaking The Anxious Generation, and got to know the couple. Chan admired him so much for his previous book, The Coddling of the American Mind, that she invited him to dinner with her and Zuckerberg. A source close to the couple points out that Mark and Priscilla regularly invite people from all different backgrounds to visit and share their perspective. Zuckerberg indicated that he disagreed that there was any casual relationship between social media and mental health, and insisted there was no scientific consensus on the matter. Later, Meta would lobby against the bipartisan Kids Online Safety Act, while Haidt would comment that Zuckerberg does bear some personal responsibility for a spike in suicides among children who used Facebook's apps. Chan, it seemed, took her husband's side on the matter. In 2020, when asked on the Today Show about social media platforms and how parents can protect their children, she replied, with everything where there is physical danger or threats to their mental health, you teach them how to use it. Use something safely. As a parent, I also need tools. You might be looking at their social media, or whatever it might look like. We need to monitor, have a gradual release, and expect tools to help us along the way. In other words, parents should police what their kids are seeing on Facebook, not the company, as if parents could possibly regulate the all-powerful algorithm. In the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, Facebook's controversial actions came crashing through the doors of CZI. In response to the protest, Trump had posted on Facebook, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Despite public outcry to stop Trump's incitement of violence, Zuckerberg and his team at Facebook made the decision to keep it up. More than 140 CZI-funded scientists wrote a letter to Zuckerberg arguing that Facebook had violated its own guidelines, and that the spread of deliberate misinformation and divisive language is directly antithetical to CZI's stated mission. Chan and Zuckerberg responded with a statement stressing that CZI was separate from Facebook and that it remained committed to an inclusive, just, and healthy future for everyone. But that didn't contain the matter. Norda Chan's emotional promise to the staff over Zoom that she and Zuckerberg stood with the black community. A question was asked about Zuckerberg stoking the flames of racial violence on Facebook, and Chan tried to assure them again that we are two separate organizations, but I want you to know that Mark feels very similarly to how I do about the current situation. In a subsequent Zoom meeting soon after, Zuckerberg joined Chan, and staffers' complaints snowballed. One after another, they gave emotional pleas, expressing their feeling that he had betrayed the company's values. One said she was losing sleep over decisions Facebook was making. Another went so far as to ask Zuckerberg if he would consider stepping down from either CZI or Facebook. He seemed unfazed by this. "We believe that Black Lives Matter and that it's important to say that, and I have said that," he told them. "We also need to get through this moment in a way where we have all our values intact going forward. And for me, a lot of what that means in a democracy is supporting giving people a voice even when you do not like what they say." Chan tried to remind people yet again that the work CZI was doing had nothing to do with her co-founder's other job. "This is not what we work on at CZI," she said. "The collective mission at CZI is what I want to lead us to go charge at." But the message no longer seemed to fly. A scientist pressed Zuckerberg about who exactly was making content decisions at Facebook and how. In response, Zuckerberg tried to assure the group that the company's automated systems were on top of it. "Making sure we're proactive about reducing harm on the platform is a huge priority," he said. "There are about 20 categories of harm that we track." His responses really felt like an insult to the intelligence of CZI employees, recalls Reynoso, the former CZI engineer, who says she was one of the more confrontational people on the Zoom. "I would have rather him come out and just say he was letting Trump flout Facebook's rules out of political expediency." In reaction to what they were hearing and wanting to be part of the Black Lives Matter's efforts, the couple announced that CZI would make a $500 million commitment to leaders and organizations that supported racial equality. It would launch, for example, a partnership with four historically black medical colleges and a science diversity leadership program to fund historically underrepresented faculty in biomedical services. As the couple wrote in its annual letter that year, "We started CZI because we believe everyone deserves the chance to reach their full potential. But systematic barriers have long denied many black, indigenous, and Latinx people that chance." In line with this awareness, when COVID hit, CZI stepped up with large-scale testing, particularly in underserved areas of California. "The legacy systems just weren't ready to do that," says Bargman. At the same time, however, there seemed to be growing concern over political optics, according to multiple former staffers. So much so that the communications department was one of the approving parties for grantees. A CZI spokesperson says, "Like in any other organization, communications is a strategic function whose work is wholly in service of our programmatic goals. Final decisions about programmatic grants are made by the respective leaders of our initiatives in alignment with strategy." Meadows recalls that his team would sit in front of a whiteboard where grantees were classified by left, right, and center. "If we fund the ACLU, then we have to fund Y, meaning a Y factor, not the YMCA. We knew we had to offset things constantly," is how he characterizes the thinking. "We're not looking at these things and asking what the best solution is. We're looking at what's going to rock the boat the least, and in my mind, won't disrupt Facebook's business interest." Meadows left the company in September 2020 and shortly after filed a racial discrimination complaint against CZI. CZI responded that the claims were previously raised internally, independently investigated, and found to be unsubstantiated. Indeed, Chan and Zuckerberg drew criticism for donating some $400 million for safe voting booth infrastructure during the pandemic. Even as Facebook became a prominent platform for spreading anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. Republicans, claiming that the donation was a partisan effort to help get Democrats elected, called the donation Zuckerbucks, and Trump blamed Zuckerberg for helping Biden win the 2020 election. Other billionaires might have laughed off the complaints, but Chan and Zuckerberg scrambled to change tack. In 2021, after rebranding Facebook as Meta, the couple hired Brian Baker, a prominent Republican strategist, to seemingly help repair relations with Trump and his allies. They publicly announced that the voting infrastructure donation was always intended to be a one-time thing and that they had no plans to repeat it. And they took their first baby steps away from work that had the whiff of activism. Starting in 2021, CZI spun off its work in criminal justice and immigration into two separate organizations, the Just Trust and FWD.us. 2 years later, they wound down education advocacy, shifting its focus in that arena to AI. The moves were subtle, but among its idealistic staffers, something was getting lost, and Chan was harder to reach. According to one, in meetings, she seemed to be deferring to Zuckerberg more and more, and folks began asking one another every day, who has Priscilla's ear? And then Trump was back. In the lead up to the 2024 election, Zuckerberg had been confronting an FTC lawsuit for allegedly maintaining an illegal monopoly, a suit that could force Meta to break up and potentially knock down his estimated $207 billion net worth. He tried to stave it off with a settlement, but was unsuccessful. Now, following Trump's victory, CZI staffers watched with dismay as their co-founder steadily made his MAGA transformation. From his invitation to Dana White, UFC CEO and Trump pal, to sit on the board of Meta, to his announcement that Meta would rid itself of fact-checkers, to showing up on Joe Rogan's podcast sporting his new Manosphere look. The comment to Rogan that the workplace could use some more masculine energy particularly rankled. At least one person wondered how Chan could have abided it. According to another source, when a question was raised at CZI about Meta's $1 million contribution to Trump's inauguration, the response came down, "That's Meta's prerogative and it has nothing to do with CZI." Curiously, however, the moves CZI then took were precisely in line with what Zuckerberg needed to remain in good favor with the current administration. CZI stopped funding the two social justice organizations it had spun off 4 years earlier. In January, after Meta announced that it would end DEI hiring practices, CZI assured worried staffers that decisions made at Meta would have no impact. But a few weeks later, after Trump issued an executive order targeting DEI, CZI followed suit, closing its DEI team too. Dozens of grantees' plans for the future have been thwarted. Buttoning up that entire era, the primary school announced it would be shuttering, a CZI investment that had once been celebrated for lifting up the most underserved children of the community. CZI said it would donate $50 million to the community, in part to assist impacted families. A source with knowledge of the situation says that the school had no endowment and had failed to scale, which was part of its original goal. In May, the editor-in-chief of Inside Philanthropy, David Callahan, wrote, "I can't recall another mega-donor couple backtracking so completely from their early ambition." Former DEI head Maurice Wilkins has watched with dismay as Chan's foundational passion to take luck out of the equation seems to have fizzled. That idea has completely disappeared, he claims. And so my assumption is that they decided that they want to do what's in the best interest of remaining the richest people in the world. Reynoso, the former CZI engineer, echoes that view. By the time she left, it felt like Chan was serving the purpose of helping Zuckerberg launder his wealth into prestige. It felt like we were becoming a place where any benefit to wider society was a secondary effect. This has all necessitated something of a public rebrand for CZI, which involves downplaying the promoting equality thing. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.